case for argument is 21-1378, Veterans Warriors versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Lee, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Timothy Lee on behalf of petitioners. Petitioners challenge seven parts of VA's final rule on the caregiver program. I understand that there is a pending motion on standing, but in my limited time, I will focus on three of the seven challenges because petitioners are confident on standing. The first challenge.
Could we discuss a couple of these standing issues?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, setting aside in person each time, the supervision, instruction, protection definition, what about the 70% disability rating for a serious injury?
Yes, Your Honor. Petitioners have standing for the 70% service connection requirement because Timothy Chilson has a 60% disability rating, and he requires assistance with multiple ADLs, and he also requires assistance with supervision or protection because he has a seizure disorder. He plans to file a new application within a few months of any successful VW challenge to the rule.
Okay. Your supplemental declaration seemed to be trying to map onto the old regulation version of the definition for serious injury. And I was trying to understand, do you think that you need to establish that Mr. Chilson could satisfy the old version of the serious injury regulation? Or is your position simply that today's rule requires a 70% disability rating and Mr. Chilson just has a 60% rating? And but for this new regulation 70% requirement, Mr. Chilson would qualify under the new rule.
Correct, the latter, Your Honor. Okay. The final rule is currently in effect. If Mr. Chilson files an application, he won't be evaluated under the old rule. He will only be evaluated under the new rule. And so he has standing.
What about the in-state requirement?
Yes,
the
Your
other
Honor.
Side says, well, you aren't harmed. Mr. Rie is not harmed by the in-state regulation because he was already denied these benefits to enter this program under the prior version of this rule.
We disagree, Your Honor. The same analysis applies. If Mr. Ray applies under the 2021 rule, which he actually did apply, he's rejected based on the final rule. And so if he applies again, or if he applied in 2021, he's not evaluated under the old rule. The old rule is irrelevant to the analysis because he has standing under the new rule. And there's no bar on reapplication. There's no claim preclusion. A veteran could apply again in the future, and there's no dispute that he would be evaluated under the new rule and not the old rule.
So it's good enough, according to your view of standing, if he would have standing to apply but for the problematic terms. It's irrelevant whether he necessarily would have qualified for benefits under the old rule because it's no longer in effect.
Correct, Your Honor. Unless the court has further questions on standing, I will go to the merits.
I will say I'm having trouble finding any declaration that supports the three of seven. If once you get to the very end, which is your seventh one, is there a declaration that points to that and someone who would be particularly impacted by three of seven daily life activities?
Yes, Your Honor. Jason Wright has standing to challenge the unable to self-sustain requirement. That one is actually, there's two ways to qualify under unable to self-sustain. One is the three of seven ADLs, and the other is a continuous need for supervision.
He's in the continuous category, not
yes.
The three of seven. So how do I address whether the three of seven is right or wrong, since you don't have a person who would be impacted by that particular portion?
VW disagrees that we do have several veterans who are affected by more than three ADLs.
I don't have any declarations in this case to that extent. That's the problem.
Yes, Your Honor. We have a declaration from Todd Cervello. One moment. Yes, Todd Cervello, he has 100% disability rating due to PTSD and TBI, and he requires assistance for all of his ADLs. And VA has also indicated that Todd Cervello reapplied under the 2021 regulation and it was denied.
But he satisfies the three or more ADL provision because he's in his declaration identified, I don't know, four or five different ADLs that he needs help with.
Correct, Your Honor.
So he's not being harmed by a requirement that you have to have three or more ADLs because, in fact, he satisfies that.
Well, it's the VW's position that he satisfies the requirements and he should qualify for the program, but VA, however, has denied his application. So if he's not eligible for benefits, then he has standing. And so the issue with standing is
he doesn't have standing to challenge the 3 of 7 if the 3 of 7 isn't the reason they denied him. If it has no impact on his personal situation, then he doesn't have standing to challenge that.
Well, actually,
that should be injury in fact. He doesn't have an injury in fact by virtue of that particular section.
It is a little bit unclear which part of the regulation he was denied under, and so VA is not particularly clear on the reasons why the veterans are denied. Okay. They might list like a laundry list.
Why don't we let you get to the merits?
Yes.
We've got a lot to cover. So,
yes, Your Honor.
You want to start with in need of personal care services?
Yes. The first challenge to VA's final rule is that VA's final rule redefines the statutory requirement that a veteran be in need of personal care services. The statutory text expressly defines in need of personal care services at 38 U.S.C. section 1720G A2C because it states that a veteran is in need of personal care services because of an inability to perform ADLs, a need for supervision or protection, or a need for regular or extensive instruction, or such other matters as the Secretary considers appropriate. But the final rule states that for a veteran to be in need of personal care services, that veteran must require in-person services. This violates the plain text of the statute, which expressly states that a veteran is in need of personal care services because the veteran has a need for such services.
This is the Family Caregiver Program, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And it seems like this is contemplating having a family member in the person's home that can provide daily consistent caregiving in a way that and provide that person compensation for that so that that person doesn't need to be outside the home to do a different job.
Correct, Your Honor. That is one of the intents.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is why wouldn't the Family Caregiver Act be understood as having an in-home person providing this care in a face-to-face kind of a way?
Right, Your Honor. So the statute actually expressly addresses this specific issue. It defines that the term caregiver, it defines the term caregiver, the term family caregiver, and the term family member. And it explicitly provides that a family member does not need to reside with the veteran in order to qualify as a family caregiver. But if the caregiver is not a family member, then that caregiver must reside with the veteran. So it explicitly...
Right. Okay. And then there's references in here on making, under the statute, the stipend amount won't be less than what would be paid by a commercial in-home healthcare facility paying one of their employees. And that seems to further bolster the idea that this is a in-home caregiving kind of program.
Yes, so VA confuses the services of a home healthcare entity with the definition for in-person personal care services. And so, you know, the services of a home healthcare aide and a commercial home healthcare aide may or may not be in person. That's not established in the record. It could also be not in person. And in contrast, the statute itself expressly defines personal care services and in need of personal care services. So the meaning of the statute is clear that in need of personal care services simply means that the veteran needs personal care services and not that a veteran who may need personal care services is disqualified simply because those services may not be in person.
Well, so what I understand the definition at number 4 of personal care services to be is it says it's, you know, covered veteran under B means services that provide the veteran the following. So it's talking about the type of services, like assistance with one or more ADL. Why isn't the word personal itself, why isn't it totally reasonable for the government to interpret the word personal in the personal care services as requiring the in-person part?
Well, first, Your Honor, under Chevron Step 1, we wouldn't go to whether the government's interpretation is reasonable or not, because the statute itself is clear. It defines personal care services.
But I'm saying that, but it doesn't. For the statute to be clear, it would have to say the services can be provided either in person or not in person. That for the plain language to clearly govern, it would have to be the conclusion that no one reading this statute would otherwise reasonably believe that Congress left that question open, right? Isn't that the way we look at it for step one? I just don't see any language that clearly says the services can be performed outside the home, for example, which is what you would like me to do.
Well, actually, yes, Your Honor, there is language in the statute that shows that the services can be provided outside the home. For example, there's the Program for Caregiver General Support Services, and the statute actually...
Well, no, that talks about the fact that the caregiver can be trained in order to provide personal care services outside the home. The caregiver's training can occur outside the home. That doesn't talk at all about whether the things he is trained or she is trained to do would have to occur in a home.
Petitioners disagree on that point, because the Program for Caregiver General Support Services also uses the term personal care services in exactly the same way.
I'm sorry. You're now talking about the more general one, not the family one.
Yes. So there's the Program for Comprehensive Assistance to Family Caregivers.
Right.
That's part A of the statute.
And I thought you were talking about, because I remember there's a portion of this statute that says the family caregiver can be trained to provide the personal care services remotely or over the internet or whatever. And I thought that's not what you're talking about.
Yes, separately, the VA also provides, the statute also states that the
What are you talking about right now with which is where you say, show me which section of the statutes, I have it right here.
Yes.
Indicates that personal care services can be performed outside the home.
Yes. So that's part B of section 1720G, little letter B. And so in part B, it provides for Program for General Caregiver Support Services, and it uses the exact same setup as in part A, and it says that the veteran requires personal care services because of an inability to perform one or more ADLs, need for supervision or protection. And so here...
I'm sorry, can you point me to where in the statute...
You're going fast, so we're just trying to catch up with you.
Where in the general care support services subsection are
Yes,
you?
It's 38 U.S.C. section 1720 G B 2.
B3A2, right?
No.
B2.
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 Oh, sorry,
yes,
B2.
Your Honor.
Okay.
And it says, for purposes of this subsection, a covered veteran is any individual who needs personal care services because of an inability to perform one or more activities of daily living, a need for supervision or protection based on symptoms or residuals of neurological or other impairment or injury. And so these first two factors are the same exact factors as in the Part A of the statute. And so VA has said that, you know, even if a veteran doesn't qualify for the Program for Caregivers, the caregiver program, the caregiver can still elect to receive benefits under Part B of the statute. And the same section...
I will tell you, I find this to be the most confusing argument in the case. So I'm glad you're focusing on it. I guess I don't understand how the word personal care services here in the same statute could have a different meaning than earlier. Why isn't it reasonable to assume that this B2 provision also requires in-person?
Neither of them require in-person.
I understand that you would
yes,
like
sir.
That to be the result, and I'm agreeing with you that I think everything has to be construed consistently.
Correct, Your Honor.
But why wouldn't it be perfectly reasonable for the VA to say this one, just like the other one, requires in-home support?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, I can point you to section 1720GB1, and it says that the program for caregiver support services includes caregivers who do not reside with the veteran, and so that supports that the...
Yes, but the caregiver doesn't reside with the veteran. That doesn't mean they don't come to the house. I mean, haven't you ever had an elderly family member that has nursing services come to the home to provide support and that kind of thing? I mean, the fact that person doesn't live with them doesn't preclude them from getting support.
Correct. It suggests that that the caregiver does not need to be present in the
home. No, it doesn't suggest that at all. It just suggests they don't have to live with them. Where does it suggest? Where exactly does it suggest the caregiver doesn't have to be present to provide the care services?
You're correct, Your Honor. It doesn't say those exact words. But the statute here also uses the word in person. And so the statute section...
But only when it's talking about educational services.
Exactly. So Congress knew how to use the word in person when Congress meant to, and Congress expressly provided that VA should provide in-person training to the caregivers, but it did not. Congress did not require that the personal care services be provided in person to the veterans.
But, you know, the what's good for the goose is good for the gander in the same way that there's nothing in the statute that says, well, you know, clearly the Congress understood how to refer to remote-based things, and nowhere in this statute does it suggest that the personal care services provided to a veteran can be somehow done remotely.
You're correct, Your Honor. It doesn't say one way or the other about whether that's allowed.
Do you have another rule you want to focus on or
yes.
Do really quickly?
Just finishing up on the in-person challenge, we believe under Chevron Step 1 that the pro-veteran canon should also be considered. All the tools of statutory construction should be considered before finding that the statute is truly ambiguous. The
Did
next
you
challenge...
argue that in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
At Step 1?
Sorry?
At Step 1.
Yes, that's in our reply brief.
I don't remember it in your blue brief.
It's on page 2 of the reply brief, the gray brief.
How about the blue brief?
Your Honor, it is in the step 2 analysis in the blue brief.
Okay, it's in step 2.
The next challenge to VA's final rule is that the final rule redefines the statutory requirement that a veteran have a serious injury. The statutory text expressly defines a serious injury at 38 U.S.C. section 1720.
No, it just says including the following. It says that a serious injury includes traumatic brain injury, other mental health disorders, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So,
but suppose that my mental health disorder was just something quite simple and not very serious, like ADHD or something. And I'm not saying that's never serious. Please don't misunderstand me. But suppose my version of it. Or, in fact, some people can have traumatic brain injury and be rated 0% disabled, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Meaning it really doesn't have any significant impact on their life function, or they would have gotten some disability rating for it. So the statute clearly isn't meaning to encapsulate all examples of those things that are in the including category. So why isn't the word serious injury and then those things in the parentheses, the types of injuries, which if serious enough, are the type that would give rise to these benefits?
Well, the statute doesn't say if serious enough.
Well, it says serious injury.
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
But not all mental health disorders are serious injuries.
Based on the plain text of this statute, all TBIs, psychological traumas, or other mental health disorders are serious
injuries.
Other
mental health disorders is a really broad category, right? So you're saying all mental health disorders are considered serious injuries for which people are eligible for these benefits?
Well, in that case, you would go back to one of the canons where you would maybe look at the third term and analyze it in comparison to the first two terms. So it would be mental health disorders similar to a TBI or other psychological trauma. And so just because a veteran has a serious injury doesn't mean that the veteran will get benefits. The veteran still needs to satisfy the requirements for ADLs or a need for supervision or protection. And so this statute says that a serious injury includes TBI, even if the TBI is rated at less than 70%. In fact, there's no...
Well, what if the TBI is rated zero?
Yes, it does.
It covers that too?
The definition for serious injury is in the statute and covers that TBI, but that doesn't mean that the veteran qualifies for benefits.
Right, okay, so the parenthetical, in your view, defines serious injury.
Correct, Your Honor.
Any rated TBI is a serious injury, in your view.
Correct. There must be a service connection for
what,
TBI.
What if it's some other kind of injury other than the three itemized ones? Would we know when someone, you know, has a serious injury? Let's say the veteran has a bum knee. How is the VA going to determine whether the knee injury, ailment, condition is of a quality that it is a serious injury?
The petitioners don't have a standing, position on whether one of the injuries that is not specifically listed requires a service connection, specific disability rating or not. That rule wasn't promulgated by the VA.
So just to be clear, is it your argument then that the word serious injury must include any version of a mental disorder, any version of a traumatic brain injury, and then when it comes to all other kinds of injuries, what happens? I mean, then what? You know, how does the VA has to determine if they're serious or not, right? Because the word including doesn't mean, and it excludes everything else. It means including, right, at least these items.
Correct. That's petitioner's position, that the serious injury must include at least a TBI or other mental disorders that are comparable to the TBI.
No, but that's not reasonable. Other mental disorders that are comparable to the TBI. Why? That's not what the statute says. It says, or other mental disorders. So that would theoretically include any mental disorder. If you're saying comparable to the TBI, you're doing that only by virtue of the word serious, which means you're trying to give meaning to that word. There are lots of mental health disorders that are not similar to a TBI, right?
It's based on the statutory tool where the third item in a list is considered, it's not considered to be everything, but should be looked at in context of the first two elements of the list. And so it's based on the statutory text itself.
So is it your view that the term serious injury is partially unambiguous and partially ambiguous? Partially unambiguous in the sense that it itemizes three things that can be serious injuries, but then for any other kind of injury, like a knee condition, the serious injury term is ambiguous?
It may or may not be ambiguous, but we know that the final rule itself disqualifies a veteran with TBI, service connection for TBI, based on the rating, even though the statute plainly contemplates that a TBI is included as a serious injury.
Okay, so if the rule had said 10% disability rating qualifies as a serious injury, you would say that's invalid.
Correct, Your Honor, based on the plain text of the statute.
Okay, is there another provision you want to get to? Why don't you get to need for supervision, protection, or instruction? Because that seems like an odd duck one to me.
Yes, Your Honor. The statutory text at 38 U.S.C. section 1720G A2C expressly states that a supervision or protection relates to neurological impairment or other injury, and regular or extensive instruction relates to an impairment to a veteran's ability to function in daily life. But VA's final rule replaces the statutory text with VA's own definition that a veteran must have an impairment that directly impacts personal safety on a daily basis. VA claims it combined these two statutory criteria because it cannot distinguish between them. But a court cannot wave the ambiguity flag because a statute might seem unclear on a first read. There's also no text in the statute to support that a veteran must have an impairment.
Well, two little I doesn't say anything about daily basis, right? But three little I actually uses the words daily life. So maybe the daily life component would be okay for the regular or extensive instruction or supervision because that's what that statutory section says. But for two little I, it doesn't say anything about in daily life.
Well, petitioners disagree about the three little I as well, because that text states that a veteran may qualify for benefits based on a need for a regular or extensive instruction due to an impairment to the ability to function in daily life. For example, a veteran with children.
Well, so the reason I think that you have a great case on three little I don't know what you're about to say, but I feel like you're going off in a direction different than I want to, so I'm going to take you where I want, which
yes,
is
Your Honor.
That doesn't say anything about safety. It just says seriously impaired. It doesn't
Correct.
Say you have to have a risk, a safety risk. You can be seriously impaired without necessarily having a safety risk.
Correct. For
right?
example, a veteran with children, the safety
oh,
risk
so
might
we're
be
gonna
to...
Oh, we're going to go there. Okay,
yes.
Good.
The safety risk might be to the veteran's children as opposed to the veteran himself. And so that would be that would qualify under the statute. But the final rule requires that the risk to safety be to the veteran himself. And so that... is contrary to this subsection.
So are you saying that it's still safety-centric?
It may or may not be, but at least...
Well, what else?
It's not a requirement that it be the veteran's personal safety.
Well, three little I doesn't say anything about safety. Doesn't use the word safety. Only two little I does.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, aren't there other daily life functions that would be seriously impaired that...
Don't,
nothing to do with safety.
Like, for example, I can't shower or use the toilet or whatever. I mean, those seem pretty significant. Those seem like serious impairments to me, but they don't necessarily have anything to do with safety.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, is there any other one you want to hit upon? Your time is so badly over, but if you want to hit on one more, we'll give you a freebie. Go ahead.
Maybe I'll just quickly summarize the last three. For the geographic residence requirement, the text states that when geographic residence matters, it matters for the benefit amount. So geographic residence should not matter for eligibility. And for the GS scale requirement, it states that the benefit amount shall be a commercial rate for a home healthcare entity. And neither a commercial rate nor a home healthcare entity rate. And lastly, for the 100% assistance with ADLs and the inability to self-sustain requirements, the text does not contemplate excluding veterans who require 99% assistance for all ADLs. And so, in closing, the statute will rarely ever be truly ambiguous after the court applies all the tools of construction, and so no deference should be given to VA under Chevron Step 1. And under Chevron Step 2, the...
Okay, your version of quickly and my version of quickly are definitely not the same. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and hear from the government. Is it Ms. Bay?
Yes.
Ms. Bay, please proceed.
May it please the court. My intention is to, I think, touch on the same issues that Mr. Lee just touched on. As Your Honor stated, there are many issues here. So in the interest of time, that was my plan, unless the court has, of course, questions on
Do you agree Mr. Chilton has standing to challenge the 70% rating for a serious injury?
We think that if the court decides to accept Mr. Chilson's supplemental declaration, which I think that petitioners moved to file like 4 or 5 days ago, then I think that we probably wouldn't be able to contest standing on that anymore. If the court determines that such submission is untimely, then we would think his original declaration does not.
Why not? His original declaration says he was 60% disabled and that he couldn't perform lots of daily life functions.
His original declaration, at least to my reading, appeared to say that he was recently discharged and that he didn't qualify under the 60%. However, as we stated in our supplemental brief, Mr. Chilson was actually discharged in 2018, and that would have been under the old version of the regulation. So
is that relevant? Why isn't Mr. Lee correct that the question isn't, would you have gotten benefits under the old version, but rather, does this, which is now in effect, prevent you from getting benefits that, but for the error he's arguing, you would get?
I think that Mr. Lee's point on that makes sense, and that's why I think that if the court considers the supplemental declaration, then we would not contest standing on that ground anymore, because I think the supplemental declaration is a lot clearer on the nature of his discharge and his plan to reapply in a way that the first declaration.
I just want to make it really clear for my purposes when you said his position makes sense. What I was referring to is the fact that his argument, I have to prove injury in fact from this regulation, and I can show that but for these problematic terms, this veteran would be awarded benefits. That's all he needs to establish for standing. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but given that his original declaration said that he was discharged, and as it turns out in 2018, we don't think that the first declaration sufficiently states that but for this 70% rating, he would have been accepted, given that he was dismissed on grounds that had nothing to do with the 70% rating, that there might be many other factors, whatever the factors were for which he was originally dismissed, that would prevent him from getting benefits in spite of the 70, or in addition to the 70% rating. But as I said, I think the supplemental declaration makes that a little bit clearer, talking about how his condition has worsened and such.
Just so that I'm clear, are there any of these terms for which you believe they have still failed to satisfy the standing requirement?
Well, as Your Honor mentioned, I think that the inability to perform three ADLs as part of unable to self-sustain in the community, I don't think any of their declarations specifically discuss that, as Your Honor noted. Secondly, I think, and I don't think we put this as clearly as we potentially could have in our supplemental motion, but in regard to the continuous requirement of unable to self-sustain, I don't think that Mr. Wright, so I guess just to backtrack a little bit, I know this is a little bit convoluted.
Yeah, I guess getting to Mr. Wright, I'm trying to understand, should Mr. Wright be in legitimate fear that he's going to get kicked out of the program? Because his issues, right, his dark thoughts that come upon him pretty regularly, you know, he needs someone right there, his wife, at all times when he's going through those dark experiences, but it's not constantly happening. But nevertheless, couldn't it be said that for him, he does need continuous care or someone there with him on a daily basis for protection purposes?
Well, Your Honor, that's why I think that in our supplemental brief, we were not challenging Mr. Wright's standing to challenge the functional impairment that directly impacts his ability. We're not challenging his standing on that ground. I think we're only challenging his standing on the ground of need for supervision, protection, or instruction on a continuous basis, because that specific clause only applies to the level of the stipend. It does not apply to eligibility, and Mr. Wright makes no factual allegations with regard to the amount of his stipend being reduced as a result of that clause. And so we're not challenging his standing to be able to challenge eligibility on some of these other grounds he mentions, but he doesn't say anything about how his stipend would be reduced because he can't meet the continuous basis.
Are you saying, getting back to the supervision, instruction, protection definition, that Mr. Wright is, in fact, harmed by that requirement in the regulation about personal safety on a daily basis? Because what he has described as his condition doesn't satisfy that regulation?
We're not contesting that Mr. Wright has sufficiently established standing for veteran warriors to challenge that aspect.
He's harmed by that.
Well, we wouldn't concede that he's harmed. I don't think we concede that he's actually harmed, but without doing a factual dive into this. But I think he has established for the sufficiency of standing purposes the likelihood of harm, I think, is the line that we would draw there. But again, we don't think that he has satisfied the continuous basis and unable to self-sustain, because that goes to the level of the stipend rather than to eligibility.
And sorry to ask this question, this is a little complicated, but if we were to strike down the regulation that defines supervision, instruction, protection, would that necessarily destabilize the definition of unable to self-sustain?
I don't believe that. So if the court were to strike down the aspect of the regulation that talks about need for supervision, protection, and instruction, I don't believe that that should negate or at least automatically negate the definition of unable to self-sustain. Because for one, unable to self-sustain is not a phrase, neither the definition nor the phrase unable to self-sustain is a part of the statute. Rather, it's an exercise of VA's gap-filling abilities, because all the statute does is direct VA to establish a schedule. I don't know if it uses the words here, but it essentially directs VA to establish a schedule for determining levels of stipend depending on various factors. And so VA was within its explicitly delegated gap-filling authorities to come up with this definition of unable to self-sustain in order to reach the 100% stipend level. And then the factors it uses to determine unable to self-sustain are, again, not in contradiction to any aspect of the statute. Moving on to the few aspects of the regulation that Mr. Lee discussed. Just very quickly with regard to in-person, we didn't touch on this too much in our brief. We mostly concentrated on step two of Chevron, mostly in the interest of the word count limit, to be frank. But we do think that to the extent that the statutory framework and congressional intent points one way or the other, it certainly points in favor of in-person. And we do want to point out that I think...
Let's start with the in need of, government's interpretation of in need of as demanding that the personal care services be done in-person. Let's assume for the moment, I don't think that makes any sense. What's your backup argument?
Sorry, I'm not sure I quite understood your question.
Well, as I understand your position, you relied on the phrase "in need of" for in need of personal care services as the key phrase that requires the personal care services to be done in person. In need of equals in person, as I understand the government's position. Am I wrong about that?
I think we pointed out that the statute does not define the entire phrase in need of personal care services, and our position is that the statutory framework as a whole supports the statement that in need of personal care services indicates that those personal care services should be in person.
So in order for us to understand the government's interpretation, we have to know what language it is that you believe imbues the meaning that you're asserting. So do the words personal care services standing alone in the government's interpretation require in-person performance?
I think, yes, for the purposes of PCAFC, they do.
That's a problem.
You're saying personal care services in context of the general care services provision? Doesn't mean in person?
It's the same phrase, right, and in the same statute. I don't think I'm speaking one way or another in terms of.
Well, you kind of have to, because you told us we should look at the statutory context as a whole 10 seconds ago, and that's part of the same statute.
It is, but there are differences in PGCSS and PC. AFC, and just to make it clear, I'm not stating that VA couldn't determine that PGCSS services had to be in person. I'm stating that at least for the purposes of PCAFC, and I know that
But you want us to find that the words personal care services unambiguously require in-person under the statute.
And I think
that would apply to both, just so we're clear. That it has to. There's no reasonable basis upon which you could say that in a single statute, when the word is used repeatedly, it has a different meaning.
I think that the reason that one could treat them differently is because of the definition section of the statute. PGCSS only talks about caregivers, whereas PCAFC talks about family caregivers, and these are, of course, the people providing the personal care services.
Yes, but it makes it equally clear those family caregivers don't have to live in the home.
But I don't...
How in the world does the fact that you happen to have the same blood relationship that I do mean that your services have to be in person, as opposed to if you don't have a blood relationship, they don't have to be in person?
Well, I was actually a little bit confused as to Mr. Lee's statement that the definition says it doesn't, that the person doesn't need to live with the veteran. I may be missing it, but I did not see that in the definition of family caregiver, that the person doesn't need to live with the veteran.
The family member doesn't say family member who is a member of the family and lives with the veteran.
No,
it's
but
only
I
for the person that's not a member of the family. That person, that non-family member, has to live with the veteran.
Right, but I think Mr. Lee had said that the statute specifically said that family member meant that the person didn't have to live with the veteran, and the only reference I see to living with the veteran or not is that a family member can be someone who lives with the veteran but is not a member of the family of the veteran, and that, to us, indicates the intention for the personal care services to be in person.
Wait, in person? Let's
get back to personal care services, that term. Let's assume that this court is not going to write an opinion that says personal care services for the family caregiver program means one thing, and personal care services for the general caregiver program means something else. Let's assume we've got to say it's the same thing. That phrase. If you want to point us to other terms, other phrases for the family caregiver program that really force the answer that the family caregiver program has to be done in person, then that's fine. But if you are trying to rely on just the phrase personal care services alone as being decisive, but then tell us that personal care services means something different in the caregiver, general caregiver program, I don't think that's a position we can accept.
Well, I think, Judge Chen, you stated while Mr. Lee was speaking that there is the subsection of the statute that applies only to PCAFC about the stipend for the eligible veteran not being less than a monthly amount that a commercial home health care entity would pay. And VA, I think, explained in both its proposed and final rules that this indicates that the kind of job that they're doing would be commensurate to something a home health care aide would do. It also talks about respite care, which, to my understanding, I don't think respite care is specifically defined in the statute or the regulation, but my understanding is that those would be in-person services to relieve the caregiver, such as, you know, hospital outpatient care or adult daycare or somebody coming to your home. Excuse me?
Did you argue this?
I can't remember if we mentioned respite care in our brief, but VA definitely stated it in its proposed rule, I believe, that respite care, that the term respite care was a reason to construe the services as being in person. So it is something that VA relied upon in its rulemaking below. Moving on to the series.
So, can we just stick with this for a sec?
Sure.
Because I will be honest, I don't know what to do with it. Is the government's position that the words personal care services in this statute are what require the interpretation that the services be in person? Is it because of the word personal? Because that would actually make sense to me, just to be clear.
That's one of the reasons. We think that there's four or five reasons under the statutory framework why it should be in person, and I think the word personal, as I think we explained in our brief and as VA explained, is certainly one of those, along with the respite care issue and
but
the commercial home health care.
Under Chevron step one, that the statute is unambiguous that Congress intended them to be in person because they used the word personal care services, then you understand it applies to both, right? It applies to everywhere that term is going to appear.
Yes, I agree. And I think that if VA, I'm not as familiar with the regulations for PGCSS since PCAFC is what's at issue here, but I think if VA said that personal care services under PGCSS had to be in person also, I think that that would also be reasonable. I think that either way, everything in the statutory framework points to these services being in person, and to the extent that it's not unambiguous, I think that it's a reasonable exercise of VA's gap-filling authority. They explained, I think, extensively in the final and proposed rules, not just its reasoning for this aspect, but its reasoning for all of the aspects. Just moving quickly to the 70.
If we have to go move to Chevron step two, what is the impact of the pro-veteran canon on this analysis?
Your Honor, I understand that the placement of the pro-veteran canon is an issue that this court is still very much discussing. I think that in this particular case, this court's recent decision in Buffington v. McDonough, and we did not discuss this in our brief, but I believe that the decision came out after we filed our brief, is instructive because it states that you would defer in the face of statutory silence, and here I think most, if not all, of the aspects of the regulation are silent, and agencies here, VA, has the authority to fill gaps, and I think in a footnote to Buffington, Your Honor stated that because we hold the statutory scheme is silent, we need not resolve the party's dispute regarding the pro-veteran canon. And so to the extent that that comes into play here, I think the same rule would apply, which is that VA is exercising its gap-filling authorities rather than construing ambiguous terms, and therefore the veteran's canon dispute wouldn't necessarily need to be resolved by this court for purposes of this particular appeal.
Are there other provisions you'd like to address? I think you should go to serious injury. How about that?
Sure, I can do that. With regard to serious injury...
Is that term unambiguous?
I think that term is not defined, and it's a reasonable exercise of VA's authority.
So we have to get to step two on this one.
I think so, because there's no definition.
How could you say, you couldn't say the statute otherwise requires the 70% be adopted?
No, I right? completely agree on that. I think the statute states serious injury, and it's up to VA to define what serious injury is under its express delegation of authority. And here, VA came up
is
with...
Is it the VA's position that there can never be a serious injury that's less than a 70% rating?
It's VA's position that for the purposes of eligibility under PCAFC, it's going to define serious injury as a 70% service connection rating and explain this, I think, again, in a lot of detail in its proposed and final rules.
But
there needs to be
the
some
statute,
fresh...
Just under the statute.
Sure.
I mean, the statute doesn't give us a lot. We all understand that. And the VA's got to run a railroad over there and wants clear, administrable rules where it can find them. But the question is, why can't there be a serious injury that's rated at less than 70%, for example, 60%?
I think that under the statute itself, as Your Honor pointed out, the term serious injury isn't defined. All it does is include a series of examples, and I think we read it like the court indicated that you wouldn't say all percent service ratings in connection with these three issues would be considered serious injuries. And so I think that VA has to make a judgment call at some point about what sort of standard to put forth as to what serious injury means for the purposes of the statute. And it explained that it considered 50 and 60, and it considered 90 and 100, and it determined that 70% best fit the what they were looking for as far as serious injury, not wholly because of, but at least in part of the fact that I think 98% of the existing program already had a 70% service connection rating. They also further determined that it needed to revise the definition of serious injury because one of the spurring factors for the revision of these regulations was the 2018 passage of the Mission Act, which expanded care to pre-9/11 veterans.
Okay,
and
Mr. Lee gets himself in trouble on this provision because he can't answer the question of what a serious injury is that isn't a traumatic brain injury, psychological trauma, or mental disorder. It has to be the case that Congress intended for the VA to determine how bad a knee injury is a serious injury, right?
Yes.
And so it has to be the case that it would be... It can't be the case that it's unreasonable for you to pick a disability number rating as opposed to having to reassess each injury in a separate capacity hearing. But the problem is, and the one thing that I have some sympathy for him on from a sort of a plain meaning sort of scenario is, but what about the specifically enumerated examples, like traumatic brain injury? Why isn't it the case that Congress was indicating that all traumatic brain injuries are, in fact, serious injuries?
I think
serious injury, parentheses, traumatic brain injury. Suppose no other examples were given, just serious injury, including, in parentheses, traumatic brain injury. I mean, it just sounds pretty serious to me. I mean, so why isn't that at least always a serious injury, even if things other than the specifically enumerated ones have to make the 70% mark?
I think the answer to that, goes back to something that Your Honor said to Mr. Lee, which is that a traumatic brain injury could be rated for 0% or 10%, and in these cases, that wouldn't necessarily interfere with the veteran's ability to take care of themselves or their daily lives.
Well, if that's
lives,
the case, he would be denied under another section, right? He wouldn't need the supervision, the protection. He wouldn't have the impairments to the daily life activities. I mean, why do we need to say a traumatic brain injury isn't a serious injury? The example you're giving would make it such that he doesn't qualify under other provisions. There are other provisions that address just how disabled he must be. This is defining the types of injuries that even open the door to the possibility of benefits, not defining the impact those injuries have to have on your life.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think you said taking it alone, but I don't think you can take it alone outside of psychological trauma or other mental disorder. As Your Honor pointed out, ADHD with a 10% rating could qualify under mental disorder, and I don't think that, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not sure even Mr. Lee would state that that is a serious injury under any sort of common sense definition of the term. And there's nothing, I think, in the framework or the statute that would counsel treating traumatic brain injury, psychological trauma or other mental disorder differently from each other. And I think, as Your Honor pointed out, it wouldn't make sense to have one category of what defines a serious injury for those three issues and another for what defines, you know, a knee injury or something, an illness stemming out of herbicide exposure in Vietnam, that sort of thing. And so VA came up with a uniform definition of serious injury, in part to address the 2018 Mission Act and in another to address the, I think, unequal implementations that were occurring from their previous
definition. Okay, can I get you to move on to need for supervision, protection, and instruction?
Yes, Your Honor, and my understanding is this is one that the court has, I think, the most some of the most questions about. We don't dispute that VA sort of combined these two parts of the statute for the purposes of the regulation, but we disagree that it did so in a way that narrowed basically what the statute means or unlawfully restricted the meaning of the statute. Previously, VA's regulation. Well, I guess take a step back. The 2018 Mission Act actually added little triple I. That was not, I think, part of the original statute. And so VA needed some way to address the little triple I and its original definition under the little double.
Is it fair to say that your new definition is narrower than your previous definition in the regulation?
I don't think so. VA actually believes that the definition is broader than the old definition because the old definition actually cabined the neurological or other impairment or injury to a predetermined list of, I think, seven impairments.
Okay, but so here's my problem with let's say three little I. Your interpretation now requires that it impacts the veteran's ability to maintain personal safety on a daily basis in three little I. Daily life right there with you 100%. But where's the safety part? Safety isn't mentioned. It's just talking about a need for regular or extensive instruction or supervision without which the ability to function in daily life would be seriously impaired. What if I can't use the toilet by myself? That would qualify as a serious impairment. It has to. And that has nothing to do with safety.
Well, I guess without getting too much into the example, I mean, I think it could... I think it could implicate safety, as could most of these issues, if you were to take a broad view of the veteran not being able to safely do these activities by themselves. But I think that the statute, it's true that it does not specifically speak about safety, but VA construed the maintaining their safety on a daily basis together with a functional impairment to encapsulate what it thought that Congress was intending by this. Unfortunately, I can't find anything in the legislative history that says anything one way or the other about this, but I think that, again, I think at worst it would be silent on this point, and VA is reasonably construing this to be a functional impairment that affects the veteran's safety, personal safety on a daily basis. And I don't
think... But two little I says nothing about daily basis. Now, two little I says a need for supervision or protection. So when you talk about the word protection, I can imagine the safety component being relevant because protection from, you know, safety sounds reasonable enough, but based on symptoms or residuals of neurological or other impairment or injury, it doesn't say on a daily basis. And since three little I and one little I both say affects daily living and two little I doesn't, why would I import? They know how to use daily living when they wanted to. They used it on the bookend provisions on either side, but they didn't on this one. Why would I read it in there?
Because there needs to be some way for VA to determine the frequency of the need for supervision or protection based on symptoms or residuals of neurological or other impairment or injury. I understand Your Honor's point that it states daily life or daily living in one little I and three little I, but I don't think that anyone would seriously argue that this need for supervision or protection could be once a month and that would qualify the veteran. For the program, I think that goes against the very nature of this particular family.
Can I ask a question? When we're talking about these benefits, these family caregiver benefits, are they necessarily awarded financially based on the concept of 24/7? What if the veteran needs help showering, but he only showers every 3 days, so the family caregiver helps him shower every third day, right? Arguably, you could say that's not daily living, because it's something that happens only every 3 days. So why wouldn't something like that fit in here?
Because that veteran would qualify under the other prong, which under the first prong, not two or three of that prong, but one, which VA has specifically stated in its proposed and final rules that those activities, I think showering might be a specific, or bathing would be a specific activity that's listed as an activity of daily living. VA has been very clear that those don't need to take place every day, but just each time that the veteran performs those activities. So if a veteran needs help every 3 days and that's how often they shower, but they need that help when they shower, then they would qualify under prong little one and the definition of inability to perform an activity of daily living. So there would be no need to address their qualification under little two and little three.
Let me follow up again. I guess one of the things I'm trying to figure out is there a way for family caregivers to receive support or compensation or whatever for work that they don't perform daily? Or is it like, I mean, meaning, okay, I need to go help my family member this often, is there compensation keyed to how much time and energy they need to spend doing this, or is the compensation standardized?
This is probably more complicated than I'm needing to make it, but it's sort of both. For the purposes of determining the level of compensation, whether to compensate them, I think, at 100% or 62.5%, that amount of time that's taken into account and the amount of effort is part of making that qualification, which is why the definition of unable to self-sustain in the community is what VA came up with for the 100% level. For the question of eligibility, VA has made it clear that for activities of daily living, that the person doesn't have to do that activity every day. And I think it's also made clear that under its definition of need for supervision, instruction, or protection, it's not that the person has to... I think VA explained, and I apologize, I don't have the exact language in front of me, that it's not that the person has to, every day make sure that the veteran, like chase the veteran out the door if they have dementia and they're trying to leave the house, but rather that the person's like presence or supervision or instruction is necessary because of the potentiality that the veteran would impair their safety by being able to leave the house. And that might be a little bit garbled of an example, but I think it's just that this has to be sort of a regular or pervasive thing and not, I think, technically something that has to be done every day, as Your Honor said, something like showering.
Can I ask you just for 1 second or 1 minute or so, touch on the residence in state, and then we'll just let you sit down after.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Most of my colleagues want to keep this going all day, but residence in state?
For residence in state, I think that the statute is very clearly silent on that. There is nothing one way or the other in the statute that either expands or cabins eligibility for that. And given that, we would move to the gap-filling abilities of VA, which, again, VA has been specifically authorized to create this program in addition to its general authority to care to implement regulations for the laws it administers. And it explained in both its proposed and final rule the reason that it cabined eligibility to residing in a state. It thought that it wasn't feasible for itself to provide benefits outside of a state, specifically because of requirements like in-home visits, initial home care assessments, respite care, and that these things would be hard to implement in a consistent manner outside of the state, and that this, when coupled with the overall lack of demand for veterans outside of a state, and I realize that Mr. Ray is one example, but I think, as the court knows, there's always somebody on the other side of the threshold, but that in combination with the infeasibility of performing outside of a state and the relative lack of demand, that it was reasonable for them to determine to cabin the eligibility to those residing in a state, and that this was a reasonable exercise of its gap-filling powers, given that the statute did not speak one way or another on the topic. If your honors have no more questions, thank you for your time.
Mr. Lee will restore your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just have two quick points to raise. For the pro-veteran canon and the personal care, what personal care means. What personal means in the term personal care services. And so for the pro-veteran canon, we mentioned that we argued that it should apply in step one of Chevron in our great brief. There was some intervening concurring opinions from this court after we filed our blue brief, which raised the question of whether it was applicable to Chevron step one or Chevron step two. And so we do not believe that we waived any argument that it would apply in Chevron step one. For the personal care services term, the personal in personal care services refers to that it does not require that the personal care services be performed in person. It means that the help is personal to the veteran and is not public or professional help to the veteran. And personal is about what the veteran needs, not what the veteran receives. So the personal in the personal care services refers to the veteran, not the caregiver. And
aren't all care services personal to the veteran? I guess I don't understand. What's the distinction you're making?
There could be public services for the veteran in a hospital or other care services that are not personal to the veteran. And so the word personal, if you look at it in context of the statute, means that the veteran requires assistance with ADLs, the veteran needs supervision or protection, or the veteran needs regular or extensive instruction. And if there are no further questions, petitioners, for the reasons stated in petitioner's briefing, petitioners urge the court to set aside VA's improper requirements to the caregiver program. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission.